Join me if you would in welcoming tonight's speaker, Julie. Became my mission. And so
out of that came a whole lot of like selfishness and dishonesty. Like, I'm going to do what I need to do to feel better. And I'm not really going to worry about how other people are feeling or what's going on with them. Completely, like, just completely missing the whole thing. Like, never really connecting with people. Always just thinking, like, I'm so different and not knowing why. And that's kind of how I operated in this world. What that also looks like, you know, is, like, I'm 13 and I'm playing on the basketball team. And, like, but, like, I can't. Like, I'm all nervous, and like, I was actually did, like, really great in practices, but then would, like, do terrible in the games, because I was always full of self-centered fear, and I just was so awkward, you know? Anyway, when I first got introduced to alcohol, it was probably somewhere around 13, 14, 15, I just don't really remember how or when exactly, but I know that almost, like, I feel like there was maybe one or two times where I got to try it, and I got drunk right away. You know, it was just like that. It was like I got relief. That thing just changed inside of me where all of a sudden that fear washed away. I felt normal. You know, I felt a part of. So it wasn't very long after that I became like a daily user. You know, somewhere around freshman, sophomore year, I started to use every day. And if I couldn't get alcohol, you know, I was drinking Robitussin and finding other things I could substitute. And, you know, going into school as a freshman and, like, honor student and stuff like that, and by junior year, I dropped out. And, anything that came in between me and my drinking, you know, my family, whatever, I would throw you under the bus. Like, get me my alcohol and get out of my way, you know, and that's it. Like, I just want relief. I was starting to, right along with drinking came, like, a lot of, like, really crazy behavior. I remember, like, being, like, 14 and had, like, never French kissed a boy, and I thought that meant I was, like, gonna be, like, alone forever. It's like, oh, my life is over, you know, and that's so funny looking back. And, I would get drunk, and I really wanted, like, a boyfriend, you know? And so I'd hook up with these random guys, and, like, but the funny part was, like, each time, I'd be like, oh, this is great. Like, I got this boyfriend. It's going to be so great. I really like him, you know? And then, like, but it was just, I was drunk, and he was drunk, and that's that. And, like, I would just end up feeling so shameful afterwards. Like, I would wake up the next morning, like, so disgusted with myself, and like, now I've got this reputation and I'm totally embarrassed, you know what I mean? And now I'm like, now that feeling that I had when I had that feeling of being a loser beforehand, and now it's like, now I've got proof, you know what I mean? Now I know I'm a loser, and now like I can't show up at school, you know what I mean? And that really propelled the like drinking every day. It started off me running away from home. I was freaking out. I just didn't know how to deal. I couldn't tolerate the way I felt. I couldn't tolerate anything. I started hanging out with like people that were doing things I was doing so that it would feel better or that I had company or whatever. Somewhere in my junior year, I left home and lived with my first boyfriend. And I was completely crazy. I told a bunch of lies about my family so that it would make sense for me to have run away from home to live with him and his parents, because it didn't make sense. I was like, why would I have left home? I should be in school and all that stuff. So I told lies about my family and said, like, oh, they were, you know, unsafe to live with and abusive or whatever, which is absolutely not the case, you know, and because I wanted to drink alcohol, and I could if I was, you know, I could be in that partying scene if I lived with him, you know, and that's, like, I will just, nothing gets in between me and alcohol, you know? I will sacrifice everything, just anything. And, you know, it's funny, like, I was doing that, and I was trying to be okay, but, like, deep inside I wasn't, you know? And I know that that's like, my spirit was never, like, complete, like, my spirit was still there, and it's like it would come up in the form of guilt or shame or regret. You know, those nights when I couldn't sleep because I was, all I was thinking about was like how I, like, how is my mom doing? You know, and I knew I was, like, I knew it was destroying her that I was doing these things. But I couldn't not make these choices. Like, I couldn't not do what I was doing. You know, and I knew I was, like, I knew it was destroying her that I was doing these things. But I couldn't not make these choices. Like, I couldn't not do what I was doing. And I would think about her, and it would just, I would just, my heart would ache that I was doing. And I would think about her, and it would just, I would just, my heart would ache that I just kept going with it. You know what I mean? And it wasn't until I got thrown out of that situation, you know, I ended up going back home to my parents, because all they ever wanted was their, like, they just wanted their little girl back, you know what I mean? Like, they had just, like, loved me unconditionally my whole life, and all they wanted was their little girl to come home, you know, and they had chased me around town and showed up at the cops and all this craziness that I brought to this other family, you know? They just wanted me to come home. And so, you know, when his family was like, you can't live here anymore, I went home. But what that looked like was I tell my mom and dad, oh, I've realized that I've been making bad choices and I want to live with you. You know, I want to, like, do the right thing. But that's not the case. It was just looking at a place for now. You know, I was so dishonest and all I ever thought about was my needs. So I went back home. Now I'm like, when I lived there, I wasn't able to drink because my boyfriend at the time had a real problem with the way I behaved when I drank, which just makes sense. But I was able to, like, you know, substitute and, like, steal things from him. And so I did that. But all I really just wanted the bottle back. Like, oh man, I just love to drink. And so I went back home, and now I'm coming off of other stuff. My anxiety is unbelievable. I'm, like, trying to waitress at different jobs, and I'm, like, freaking out all the time. I can remember, like, driving, and I'm, like, pulling over on the side of the road, like, thinking I'm having heart attacks, and, like, just freaking out. I'd like, be in the middle of a work shift, and I'd just, like, you know, I would get, like, the fear would overcome me, and I would just, my vision would get blurry, and I'd have to leave in the middle of the day. So I was, like, leaving jobs left and right, you know. I somewhere in there got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd gotten taken to a meeting at 17 from him, but I didn't want any part of it and didn't see myself as an alcoholic. Then when I went back home, my family didn't really, they were really, like, all about this, they thought I was a situational alcoholic. Like, I was an alcoholic because of situations I had been in that were really difficult. And I was like, yeah, that's the problem. I've had some tough times. That makes sense. Which is ridiculous, because, like, I created any bad situation that I got into, you know? But I really thought that there were things in life that I just didn't understand, and that if I could figure them out, I would be okay. I really thought that I could be, like, this, like, I don't know if it was even a social party, or I think I had given up on, like, the whole social part, but, like, or maybe I didn't, I don't know. I don't know if I thought I could be a social partier or just, like, a functioning drunk, but either one I would have been happy with, you know what I mean? Because that was not my experience. I'm just a hot mess. It just turned out to be a blessing, you know? I mean, it's, like, gross, like, fast, you know? I got, like, 3 or 4 days before I, like, can't function, but, like, it's bad. But, so I really believed that if I could just figure out the right choices to make in life, I could, like, just get a good job or, like, have a relationship and treat that person the way I knew I should. Or, like, you know, if me and my family could just get over the crap that we had gone through together and just, like, move on, I'd be okay. Or, you know, if maybe I should just be a student, like, just go to college and, like, get a career going, you know? And, like, why can't I just do these things, you know? But the problem is, like, I miss a class and, like, or even an assignment, and I'm afraid to go to class. Now I miss, like, one class, so I can't go to the next one, and I'm too nervous to talk to the teacher about the homework that I didn't do. So, like, blah, I can't do anything. Like, I try to show up at work, but I can only make it there, like, 3 out of the 5 days a week, because the other two, I'm freaking out. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't work. You know, people won't keep you employed. Like, I can't, like, my life doesn't work on my own. And, so anyway, I, you know, what happened was I somehow knew that, I don't know what it was, I kept getting pulled to AA, and that's just, it's like, it's still surprising to me that, like, that was an option for me at that time, like, or that I would, you know, that wasn't me, like, that wasn't my choice, that wasn't my ideas. Like, I kept getting to places where I would get, it would get so dark, and I would feel so empty that I would have this willingness to go. And somehow that was, like, I somehow had this idea that, like, I would get help there. You know, and I just kept showing up, like, you know, starting between, like, 18 and 21, like, I started being a frequent meeting maker. I've never said it, saying before, I don't know why this makes me laugh. But, anyway, when things would get really... really bad, I would show up at an AA meeting, you know, and I didn't know you guys were just, like, nice to everybody. I was like, these people love me. They're so nice. I thought it was great. I was, like, 19, 20, and, like, nobody liked me at that time in my life, so I thought it was awesome. People, like, give me rides to meetings and buy me coffee and stuff like that, and, you know, compared to, like, the family that thought I was just, like, evil, because I was. You know, this was some relief. You know, it was like you people didn't know the bad things I had done. You know, you had no history with me screwing you over. And it was like, oh, thank goodness. You know, yeah, I just got to feel like normal for like an hour of my day. But the thing is, like, up until that point, if you had met me in the last 5 or so years or even more, like, your life was not better from the experience. I was not a good person. I did not have good relationships with people. You know what I mean? And even if I didn't, like, overtly screw you over, I just wasn't great to be around. I was always crazy. I was always filled with thoughts of Julie. I was always, like, bringing my cap everywhere I went. So I had all this. And then, aside from that, then there was the really lame stuff, like telling that people that my family was bad when they weren't, and, like, you know, stuff that you can't undo. And so I wasn't just a sick person. I had been a bad person. That's my experience. I was a really lousy person. And I thought that was all evidence of why I didn't deserve to get this thing, or why I didn't deserve to be happy, or why I didn't deserve that the God wouldn't care about me, and that I would never amount to anything. You know, I thought that was my proof that I'm a shitty person, and here's why. And I carried that stuff around with me, and it made me feel like I wanted to die. And without drinking, I just got worse and worse. And I had such a horrible case of bulimia when I was trying to be sober because I couldn't stand myself so much. I was throwing up all the time. And, like, I would try to make myself look as nice as possible and show up at meetings. And if you asked me how I was doing, I would tell you I was great. And then I'd go home and think about killing myself. You know, and I was going to meetings every day, sometimes, like, 2 meetings a day, sometimes 3. Not homebound jobs, living at my parents' house, trying here and there to get work, but mostly way too depressed, you know, and I was having so, my anxiety was so bad that I was hanging out at emergency room hospitals because I couldn't afford to go into them anymore, and I just sit there like, oh God, what, you know, if I die, I want to do it here so they can help me or something. I used to call 911, this is true, I used to call 911 so much, the dispatcher knew me, and she'd be like, are you sure, Julie, or you know, yeah. Are you dying here, is that the real one? I'm like, no, this time it's real, like, you better send the troops, you know, the ambulance would show, and I'm still paying off financial amends to the ambulance company, because I used to bring them to my house all the time, and that's true. It was absolutely ridiculous. That is me sober on the Julie Carey plan. It does not go so well. But the thing is, like, I was trying so hard. And people would say, like, don't quit before the miracle happens. And I'm like, where's the fucking miracle? Because I'm not experiencing it. You know what I mean? And I thought my life was going to be destined to, like, uncomfortable chairs in church basements with people I didn't like. You know, waiting for a miracle. You gotta be kidding me. You know? And that's all I was hearing. And I can't say that that's all that was said, but that's all I heard in AA. I heard just keep coming. Just keep coming. And I'd call up my sponsor, who was, you know, like, herself several years sober and hadn't even written an inventory. And she would tell me, like, she would listen to me. Like, I would call her at, like, 3 in the morning, freaking out with my problem of the day. And she would just, like, talk me through it, you know, whatever it was. And I thought that was sobriety. I thought it was like, I'll talk to you about whatever I'm freaking out about today, and then you'll talk to me about whatever you're freaking about today, and maybe, just maybe, we just won't drink just today, and we'll be okay, you know? And, like, we'll stay crazy, and we'll, like, hang out at AA meetings and, like, do nothing good for ourselves or anyone else, and, like, not worry about all the people we screw over, and we'll just hang out there, you know? And I don't know, a lot of things happened, you know? I had heart failure or something, I don't know what it was, but some sort of cardiac something or other, and I almost died sober, and I was pretty sure I was going to die sober. That's what ended up happening. Ended up spending, you know, one of those nights where I was like, I don't feel good. It was like, it was the real deal, and, you know, ended up getting rushed to the hospital at 3 in the morning, and that was scary, you know, and I was pretty sure, at that point I was thinking I was going to die sober. Like, I couldn't get insurance because I couldn't show up at work, and I couldn't stop doing the things I was doing. I didn't have the power to, you know. The only thing I had going for me was that I hadn't drank in a while, but, you know, and nothing I was doing was working, and I couldn't get into any hospital programs to, like, work on this other stuff that was going on for me, because I just didn't have the money, and I was just like this, how am I going to be okay, you know? And I started just, like, I somehow ran into this woman. She found me, actually. She was working the principles. Like, she would see me at meetings, and she'd come over and give me her number and be like, call me and let's get together. Like, she could see that I was not okay. And she was like, you know, Julie, sobriety doesn't have to be like this. Like, you don't have to suffer sober. This thing is so cool. And she would just, like, keep reaching out to me. And she wanted me to get together with her and some other women and go through the big book. And I remember they would meet on Friday nights before this meeting. And hanging out with women in a book on a Friday night was not appealing to me. The funny part is, like, I'm dying inside. But you, like, show me, like, let's do this and you'll get better. I'm like, that, I don't know about that. You know what I mean? I'm so fucking arrogant. That's the problem. Like, I think I know what I need. I think I know what I don't need. And that is the thing that will block me. You know, if I think I know, man, I'm screwing myself over. Because my experience is that I don't know. I don't have a clue, and I gotta keep putting my own ideas aside because I keep thinking I know, and it keeps coming up, you know. That's the biggest problem for me today, is to keep putting my own ideas aside and letting somebody else show me, and being open to a new experience with this stuff, and you know, that, like, whole, like, having a beginner's mind or whatever, just, like, keep being teachable, you know. But so I didn't want to do that, and so I didn't, and I went down. I think the other thing too, I just want to say this, because I feel this sometimes, like, when I try to reach out to other people, I feel that we're up against so much. Like, when we offer somebody a solution, and it's like, here, you can get well, and here's how, we're going to meet together, we're going to read through the big book, we're going to talk about the history of AA and how this thing works, and then we're going to, like, read through the doctor's opinion so you really understand the disease, and then we're going to go through this and the little story and all that. Then you're going to write an inventory of your entire life. We're going to talk about your sex conduct, your fears, and your resentments for your whole life. Then you're going to pray and meditate, and we're going to hunt down the people that you've harmed face-to-face. We're going to make amends. Like, or, you know, if you're saying this, and then you've got, like, 9 other people going, just don't drink. You know what I mean? Who are we listening to? And they're like, just hang out at meetings and drink some coffee. And just keep coming. And then in 5 years, you get your marbles back. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to think that they're going to want to be like, hey, like, I like what you're saying there with the book and the work and the stuff and the walking through our fears. Like, no. You know? Nobody's going to want to do this. And so, like, we're up against a lot. Like, I'm trying to carry this message. And where I live, like, there's a lot of meetings. If I show up and I'm like, hey, let's do the stuff, the steps, like, and now. Like, you're a month sober, great, let's go. And then, like, I got people going up to newcomers being like, stay away from her. She's one of them. You know what I mean? Like it's this plague. They call them the big book Nazis. And, like, you know, they're like, and it's true. Like, that first sponsor that I was working with, when this woman came up to me and wanted to take me through the books, that first sponsor said, you better stay away from my newcomers. You better stay away, you know, with that solution of yours. Absolutely crazy. So, I was just thinking that. I was just talking to this new girl, and she's like, desperate, she's not doing well, she's sober, you know, she keeps calling me with these problems, and I'm talking to her about, like, how to, like, live by principles, and, like, how to be well, and she's like, She's like, yeah, I think I'm just going to hang out at this meeting. But she wants help, but she, like, when I offer it, she's like, yeah, you know what? I think just, like, hanging out at a meeting and hear how other people do it, that's, like, good enough, you know? And it's just like, God, I wish people weren't telling you that that was enough. I wish they weren't, because, like, it could be so much better than what you're experiencing right now. Anyway, so, okay, back to the story. Kelly, she's 12-step-ing me, and I'm not interested. And I go down to this young people's convention, and that's where I see, that's where I see people with recovery, and I can't say that I never saw it before, but there was something about this experience. I saw people that were, like, living by principles, and I could see it in their eyes, and they were real excited, and they were laughing, and they were telling jokes, like, remember this kid before the steps? He was toxic. And they were, like, you know, just, they were really, like, they were getting some results from the work. And so it turned out, like, talking to people, the people that had, like, what I wanted and got results that I wanted had done the 12 steps, the big book. And so I went back to New Hampshire, found Kelly, and was like, let's go. You know, and it took me about 2 months. It took me about 2 months from that point to go through the book with her and get to a point where I'd written inventory and was starting to make amends. And that changed me. And then I've never been the same since. I will say, though, like, I didn't stay sober the entire time. I stayed sober. I had that experience. It was profound. Somehow, like, things happened. She moved away, and I never passed this thing on. And so all that relief that I got and like, all those changes that happened for me in the ninth step, I never gave it away. And so eventually, you know, after 2 years of sobriety, I thought that I was well, or I forgot what it was to be a drunk, or I thought I got sober young, maybe I was just irresponsible, you know, all this stuff. Anyway, whatever it was just, like, me. I can't stay sober off of the spiritual experience that I already had. Like, I gotta keep renewing it. I gotta keep having new experiences. I gotta keep doing this stuff. And I didn't do it, and I ended up drinking, for going back to drinking, and it took me another year to get back. That's what brought me to Portland, Maine. Just that a sponsor that I had, when that woman that took me through the steps went away, I started hanging out with this girl Michelle in Boston, and then while I drank, she had moved back up here, and at the end of my drinking, I knew she was up here, and a buddy of mine who I was living with while drinking had moved up here, and I ended up going into the Milestone Foundation detox, and then living at the Oxford House in town here, and really getting sober again, and starting all over. You know, and really, I had to go through every part of that process all over again, you know. You know, one thing, I guess, since I'm here, I just, you know, the first step, like, I heard somebody say, like, it's like you gotta surrender a few times. Like, I first had to surrender to the fact that I'm powerless over alcohol, which took me some time, and like, really understanding, you know, like, the, you know, hold on a second. Let me get my bearings. You know, the two ways that I'm powerless over alcohol, like, my physical allergy to it, the part where, you know, I have an allergic reaction every time I put it in my body, and I will never respond normally to it. You know, and that allergic reaction, you know, they call it, like, the phenomenon of craving. The way it was explained to me is, like, if I have chicken pox, the chicken pox manifests in red bumps on my skin. And if I have a allergy to alcohol, that manifests in this phenomenon of craving, this unbelievable craving, where once I start to experience it, I can't stop. I have no chance at not keeping going. You know, that's one part. That's one way I'm powerless over alcohol. And the other way is in the mental obsession. And that's, like, the way that was explained to me is, like, that mental obsession is, like, a persistent and reoccurring thought that is stronger than and doesn't respond to reason. So, like, I've got all this great reason why I cannot drink, and that doesn't do anything for my mental obsession, because once I get the idea in my brain that I want to drink, like, it's going to win every time. So there's no, I don't have a mental defense. I can't remember those crappy things that happened. I can't remember the night that I was like drunk in a Walmart and tried to dye my hair in the fitting room. You know, I wound up on the news because I was drunk. You know? I can't remember that. My brain just tells me this will be fun. And here's why. You know?
Sure.
Sorry, I'm still in my Walmart room. So I can't treat the physical allergy because I'll always be allergic. I'll always be allergic to alcohol. I have to treat the mental obsession. That's treated with spiritual experience. If I don't have a spiritual experience, the mental obsession will win, and I will go back to drinking. You know? And, you know, they call it spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. Like, basically, my spirit was asleep for a really long time. It wasn't completely dead. You know, it would come up in, like, when I'm away from home and, like, my heart aches for my mom. That's my spirit just, like, still being awake. You know, and I try to drown it out with more booze because I can't stand, like, being aware of my spirit because it's telling me what I should be doing. You know? And, like, that's where I got my concept of a higher power, too, is, like, I always knew what was right for me. There was never a question, like deep inside, you know? When I'm doing something right, I feel that. And then when I'm doing something wrong, I feel that, too. And that's my spirit. It's, like, telling me what's right for me and what's wrong for me. And what's right for me is different from anybody else. So, like, you know, talking to the, you know, women in this program, like, I don't ever know what's right for anybody else. Like, that's for us to decide. You know, but, like, just we have to get in touch with our own self to figure that out. And that's been, like, my barometer for, like, how to live. You know, it's been, like, this God awareness. My friend Michelle used to call it a God gut. It's, like, that's how I get it. That's how I get connected to this thing, is, like, through my feeling inside. So I've got to treat this mental obsession with spiritual awakening, which I'm guaranteed to have. I say guaranteed because I think it's guaranteed. I'm guaranteed to have as a result of doing the 12 steps. I mean, it says at the bottom of the 12th step, like having had a spiritual awakening as the result of working these steps, not a result. It is the result we'll get as if we work these steps. So, like, I didn't even have to believe that this thing would work for me. In fact, I didn't believe it would work for me. When I started meeting with Kelly and I was still crazy and she was really well, I did not see how doing steps was going to get me better. The thing that I trusted was that when she told stories about her and the way she used to be, and then I saw her sitting in front of me, she didn't match the stories. She looked really okay. And I was like, I could see that something was working for her. And she would ask me, you know, do you believe that works for me? And I said, oh, obviously, Kelly, like, I see that it works for you. And she said, well, do you believe that what works for me could work for you too? And I was like, I guess, or she even asked, I didn't even have to believe it. She asked me if I was willing to believe that it worked for her, or if it would work for me too. And I said, yeah, I'm willing. You know, I don't believe that it will work for me, but I'm willing to try to believe that it will, and that's enough. That is enough. I don't have to have this, like, overwhelming awareness that God's going to save me. It was just like, I'm willing to believe that something's going to work for me if I do this stuff. Good. You know, she told me a couple things, like, she said, you know, God loved me even at my worst, and probably more than. And I needed to hear that because I pretty much thought I was a scumbag and that God wouldn't want anything to do with me. You know, tell me things like God needed me on this planet, like, just as much as I need God, because I got to be available and, like, tap into this thing and, like, ask God to show me who I can help and then be available to help. Because there aren't, like, it's not like everybody's doing that. And sometimes people need each other. And I got to be available to that. I got to tap into that and ask to be directed and guided. So God needs me. So now I feel more like, okay, I can do this, because I'm not just asking for something. Like, I'm going to be available, and I'm going to be a part of this thing, and it's going to be a relationship. It's not just a one-way thing anymore. And that made it, like, more okay for me to be open to it. Because before that, you know, I just had a lot of prejudice against this higher power. And Kelly asked me, whatever ideas I already had about this higher power, please put them aside, whether they were good or bad, because I'm putting God in a box, and I'm saying this higher power can do these things, but can't do those, and it's like, it does work this way, but not that way. And she said every time, like, I think I know, I'm blocking myself from, like, understanding, and maybe, just maybe, there's something out there that's so much cooler than my brain can possibly understand, and I'd miss the whole thing if I just try to, like, understand it and identify it. So just She didn't tell me to get rid of my ideas, but just set them aside to have a new experience, you know, and I was willing to do that. We got into, like, doing a third step prayer, which was basically just, like, I'm making a commitment to go on to the next steps, and I don't really see how it's going to work, but I got no other options, and I kind of want to die, and you don't, so I'm going to write some inventory. That's what my third step was kind of like, you know? I was just like, all right, I'm gonna say this prayer and hold your hands, and then I'm going to write, you know? And that's what happened. I'm just doing a little time check. Okay. Just trying to see where I can go next. So anyway, I started writing my inventory. I feel like it took mostly like a long weekend, and you know, and I read it to her. What happened was my head got clear. The thing that inventory has done for me is that it took the sting out of those memories that I had, so that, you know, those, you know, like, I'm just driving up the road, chilling. All of a sudden, boom, a thought, a memory. I can't believe I did that. I was such a loser that night. Did they see me? Oh, my God, what did they think of me? What if I see them? Oh, my God. Like, that stuff would come up. And I would, like, be driving, and all of a sudden I'm cringing down the highway. Right? You know what I'm talking about? Sharing my inventories with staying away from that stuff. And now it didn't have that same pain that it used to have. I find that anytime, like, I've got problems going on, as soon as I take action, they just start to get better. And it's all about the action that I take. And like, it doesn't even have to be, like, fixing a problem. You know, it can just be just starting to take action on it. You know, maybe I get inspired. Maybe I have this bad feeling about, oh, all these people here, I need to make amends. Once I make one phone call to one person, ooh, relief. You know what I mean? I didn't do this thing because I wanted to be, like, this perfect person. I do it because I have to do it to be okay. And that's just the truth of it. You know, after sharing my inventory, like the book says, I took that hour with God afterwards. You know, after we share this thing, this inventory, I'm going to meditate for an hour. And it was the first time in my life where, like, my head was clear. And I was alone, and there was no noise and no distraction, and I was totally fine. And it wasn't like I was waiting for those minutes to just come down. It was just this, like, clarity and this peace. It was really cool, you know? And what happened was I don't even want to try to remember the exact wording of 6 and 7, but basically, it didn't mean that, like, all my character defects went away or that I stopped having these shortcomings. It meant that, like, I was willing to look at myself and to continue to look at myself and continue to grow. And as I see these things come up, I'm willing to let them go. You know, and I have character defects. You guys can see mine. I can see yours. I have a really hard time seeing my own, you know, and that's just the way it works. And, like, as I keep growing, like, I can see more, and then as I can see it, then I can get rid of it, but I keep lots of them. I fall short all the time, like, every single day, in all sorts of areas, but I keep being willing to, like, grow, and then, like, be gentle with myself through it all, you know, not, like, judge, and, like, you know, I keep thinking, I should be better, I should do this right or that right, and just really letting myself just be wherever I am, and just knowing that that's okay, and that's enough. You know, I made a list of the people I've harmed. This has been, like, the past couple months, I was lazy. Let me say this, I was lazy with my amends for a while. I did the really simple, easy ones, and then I did nothing for a few months. And because it felt good, I got relief, and then I started to feel really normal, like a normal human being. Like, oh, I'm just a person, and I go to work, and I try to be a good person, and that's great. And then my spirit started to fall back asleep. That's what happened. And I didn't even know it, but I got, like, people in my life that work a program, too. And I remember saying to, like, my friend Eric, like, dude, I'm dragging my feet with amends. And he just looked me dead in the eye, and he was like, Julie, how free do you want to get? And I was like, shit. Sorry, I didn't shoot. Free? Yeah, that'd be nice. You know, I want to be free. And so I started making more. I've been making amends consistently, like week to week as time goes by, and they still scare the crap out of me. You know, I made amends on Saturday to the mom of my first boyfriend who I lived with, you know, for all that dishonesty and the chaos that I brought into her home. I was freaking out. I'm sitting in a coffee shop and I'm waiting for this woman to show up, and I'm like freaking out. And it was so great because Brent called me while I was sitting there to like remind me about speaking, and I was just like, I'm so glad you're calling me right now. I'm waiting for this lady. You know, but I like pray through it. And the funny part is like I freak out because all I'm thinking about, I still am crippled with my self-centeredness. I'm like thinking about how uncomfortable I feel, and I feel like a loser, and I'm such a jerk. And it's so beautiful. You know, it was such a great experience. Like, she, through that whole thing, she had tried to be helpful to me. Like, she, this is a woman who lives by principles. You know what I mean? She has her own relationship with a higher power. And she had tried to, like, give me some of that and, like, instill it in me. And so for me to go back and, like, 10 years later, you know, be okay and, like, you know, it made her feel like she had, like, planted a seed or helped be a part of somebody who wasn't well to get better, and it like meant the world to her that somebody that was such a mess that she had tried to help is now okay. You know, I gotta do that. I gotta let these people heal from the way I have hurt them. You know, and like the truth of the matter is that I'm still really selfish, but my actions can be, even though I feel selfish and think selfish, I can still do the right thing, and then slowly I get a little less selfish slowly. But you know, it's not my nature to, like, think of others first. You know, I gotta force myself to do this stuff. And, I don't know. That's just the way it is. Let's see here. Another thing that, another thing I got really off track with was my 10th and 11th steps. My continuing to take an inventory. Which I was guided to. I was kind of doing this like mental inventory and thinking that that was okay. And I was guided to actually writing it out. The way it was explained to me was like, Julie, have you ever done anything productive in your head?
And I was like,
no, you haven't. And I was told I had to like write it out, you know. And and so I've been doing that, you know. And meditation. I don't know about you guys, but I need it. And I don't... I haven't been doing it every day. I do it every day, but I haven't been doing it every day in the morning. And I need to do that. It's like night and day, the difference between my day, when I meditate in the morning and when I don't. And it's only... It's like here and there, it's like random weird stuff happens where, I don't know, I'll be, like if I'm late or whatever and I can't, I just don't have the time. I have to find a way to make that time. It is, like, crucial for me, for my sanity. It just is. And then, you know, being available to other women is the most important thing that I can... Like, it is my primary purpose. My primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And, you know, it has to be, like... It has to be whenever they need me. Like, it has to be. I don't know. It's funny how I can forget and not hold that gratitude really in my heart and not feel like what a miracle it is to be that I'm even sober today and, like, forget about that and to think that, like, it's okay for me to just go off and live life. You know, this is so sacred to me. And I gotta keep reminding myself of that. And stay connected, and like I gotta go to meetings and like seek out women who look like they're not okay, and I gotta give them my number and say let's meet and I'll pick you up, and I gotta take their number because newcomers are scared to call people, and I gotta tell them about this thing, and I gotta like find a way, you know. I'm constantly like trying to figure out how can I reach out better, you know, and because it's hard, like am I too pushy and do I push them away, or like, you know, am I not adamant enough, and like, you know, just like, I just gotta reach out and make myself available because there's like 9 other people who are telling them, you know, just hang out in the Andy. You know, and they might drink and die. And that's the truth of it. Like, we're always, like, AMEs don't always serve newcomers. And that's really unfortunate. So, I was told that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, is vital to permanent recovery. And that means that it's just not, like, it's not when it's convenient for Julie. And, like, oh, I got this party this night and that night I'm going out, but, like, this morning I can meet with you. I've got, like, 2 hours. Like, no. No, it means, like, are you okay? Like, when do you need me? You know what I mean? That's what it means. You know, and I need to do that or I will stay sober. I believe that. So, I don't know. What's life like today, I guess? I seriously, like, back in, like, October, I think it was, I've been living where I live now for, like, a month, and I was doing dishes, and I just hit my knees, and I started crying, because I can't believe that I always pay rent on time, and that I buy my own food, and that, you know, people can count on me for things. If they say, I'll do something, or I'll do it. You know, these things are, like, unbelievable to me. I've never thought that I just can't believe it. So like I said, I hit my knees and I start crying. I have an opportunity today to, I just got a new job at this youth center, and I live in Lowell, Massachusetts. Woo! You guys have been around, so I'm sure a bunch of you have heard of it, have been there. I embarrass myself, I am so weird to know. So I guess I just got this job. I get to work with teenage girls in Lowell, and I love it. I just love it. I just really, really love it. In a couple weeks, I'll be starting this herbalist program, and it's something I've wanted to do for so long. I really like that kind of stuff. I just, sometimes in terms of people in my life, I feel so rich. You know, I just really love the people that I know. It's really beautiful. I'm, like, working on relationships with my family. It's like, there's just a lot of damage that I did. That's the truth of it. It's a really slow process. My family has needed tons of love and tolerance and patience from me. Because I hurt them a lot, you know. My experience was that I was so crazy that I made normal people sick. And now they need my patience while, like, they heal from that. You know, and my mom and I are building a relationship back really slowly. She recently got into Al-Anon, which she had been like, whoa. She's really, like, a strong woman that, like, can do it herself. And so it was really cool that she actually even got into Al-Anon, and she works steps, you know, which was really cool. She had a really amazing experience with it, and it really changed her. But, like, me and her, like, you know, we're on similar paths where we get well, and then we fall back and aren't as well. But it's really cool to, like, get to see her grow. And,